Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 302 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, I'm going to be continuing the topic that we started in episode 301, diabetes and the USMLEs. Again, as I've said, I know this is a diabetes podcast, but as you probably know from my other podcasts, I love to make integrations. Diabetes is just a great topic for making lots of integrations. Because the thing is, when you master those integrations, when you see these contexts as you're learning, you then just become way better at mastering the information. So that's one thing I'm going to focus on again. And, you know, hopefully I can finish it up today, but if I can't, so, and by the way, today's podcast is not going to be as long as the previous one. If I can finish it up today, I'll make a final podcast and that will complete our diabetes trilogy. But let's see if we just need a part one and a part two, right? So again, today's task is to kind of clean up some of the things I talked about last time and also talk about some things I did not talk about. And then we'll kind of go from there, right? But again, there are many ways. You may be surprised that on an MBM exam, 10% of the questions can be related to diabetes in some way, right? But again, it may not be diabetes, they're testing the question. It may just be something that is peripherally related, right? So again, it's just a matter of just, again, that's why you see these podcasts are kind of long. And then for those of you that are taking the Step 2 CT, Step 3 exam that are listening to this, remember, I have a course. First, I have an MBME test taking strategies course, the 27th of this month. It's 2.5 hours, very high yield. You'll learn systematic ways of reading questions, of answering questions, of not falling for MBME traps, even for questions that you don't know what's going on with those, right? Like, how do you approach those questions? I'll teach you all those tips and tricks and techniques as we go along in the course. And then from the 28th of April to the 1st of May, we'll be having the 20-hour Step 2 CK Step 3 course. Again, before it was 10 hours, it evolved to 16 and a half hours, but now it's 20 hours, right? Because again, I just want to include more material, especially the Step 1 material that your friends at the MBME have started caring quite a bit about and things of that nature. Okay, so let's just jump right into it, right? So again, we kind of talked about diabetes last time. We talked about how it causes lots and lots and lots of problems, right? We know that diabetes is the thing that causes, in fact, it is like one of the most common, if not the most common cause of like blindness in the US, right? Causes blindness, causes a lot of kidney problems, a lot of nerve problems, right? In fact, many people that have diabetes, right, they end up, unfortunately, losing their extremities, right? Because remember, diabetes can cause problems with sensation, and the person can get like a bad infection of the lower extremities, and then they have like auto amputations and, you know, bad things like that happening, right? And one thing I think I want to say about diabetes, remember, people that have diabetes is actually an immunocompromised state. So these people, they typically actually get the short end of the stick with regards to infection, right? Like, for example, a classic MBME question may be a person that came in with flank pain, CVA tenderness, fever, right? And then they tell you that, oh, they perform a urinalysis and they see white blood cell casts, they see white blood cells, they see bacteria, right? And obviously you're like, okay, this person likely has pyelonephritis, right? And you're like, okay, let's go ahead and give this person IV ceftriaxone. Remember, when you're treating pyelonephritis, you don't use Bactrim on MBMEs for that. You use either IV ceftriaxone or you use an IV fluoroquinolone, right? That's how you treat pyelonephritis on MBME. So you treat the person, but then you notice that, wow, 48 hours after therapy, I'll say 48 hours to be on the safe side, the person is not getting better. The person continues to have fevers and all that badness, right? And then usually on the exam, they will say, what is your next best step in management, right? And usually it's going to be in a diabetic. If you see stuff like that, you want to go ahead and get a CT scan of the abdomen, right? Because again, the person unfortunately may have a very bad complication of pyelonephritis, right? So they may have this thing called like a, they may tell you that, oh, they may see see a fluid collection around the cortex of the kidney, right? That's a perinephric abscess, right? That needs to be incised and drained. It's actually an emergency. Another thing you may see, they may tell you that, oh, you're seeing gas bubbles in the walls of the kidney, right? That's, remember, gas, emphysema, right? That's emphysematous pyelonephritis. That's actually a surgical emergency. You need to call, I think, a transplant surgeon so the person can get an emergency nephrectomy, right? If not, the person will die, right? So again, diabetics, it's almost like they get like the advanced form of most infections, or like if an infection can go bad, it really goes bad in a diabetic, right? And remember, these people can also get like mucormycosis, right? So they can tell you that, oh, it's a diabetic, has facial pain, sinus pain, right? Or they can even tell you the person has a frontal headache. If you see that, because remember, mucormycosis, it actually loves to go and torch a person's frontal lobes of their brain. That's why it's a surgical emergency, something where you have to debride extensively. And then in addition to that, you have to give those people amphotericin B, right? You need to give those people amphotericin B. And then even diabetics, right? They're the ones that usually have like neck fash, right? So like, they can, remember, you can have neck fash in the perineum. They can have this thing called a Fournier's gangrene, right? That's basically like a fancy term for necrotizing fasciitis of the perineum, right? So those are things you kind of need to keep at the back of your mind with diabetics. Even your friends at the NBME, they care that you know that, oh, you know, what if they tell you that, again, you're seeing like gas bolt. Let's say a person presents with right upper quadrant pain and very high fevers and is a diabetic. And you're seeing like gas bubbles in the wall of their gallbladder, right? I would really hope you're thinking about like gangrenous cholecystitis, right? Again, that's very life-threatening, right? It's something that you need to fix, and you need to fix relatively quickly so that the patient doesn't die, right? And then again, if I remember last time, we did talk about type 1 and type 2 diabetes, right? And again, we talked about how type 2 diabetes, they have a lot of insulin resistance, right? So some of the receptor may not be working, right? So remember, insulin uses a tyrosine kinase receptor, right? So if that tyrosine kinase receptor is not working, it's almost like having nephrogenic diabetes insipidus. It's like, oh, there's ADH around, but you have a V2 receptor problem that can be caused by like lithium or hypercalcemia or demeclocycline or anything of that sort. But in diabetes, again, it's the tyrosine kinase receptor that doesn't work. Or in some cases, some people, again, there are many genetic things that cause type 2 diabetes. And that thing can also be just your GLUT4 receptors don't work, right? Remember, your insulin-dependent tissues use GLUT4 receptors, right? So like your adipose cells, your muscle cells, they use insulin, right? In fact, the way I remember that is I remember just waking up at 4 a.m., right? Waking up at 4 a.m., right? So GLUT4 for A, adipose, and M, muscle, right? So again, if you have a GLUT4 problem, right, then you're not going to be able to, your muscle cells and your adipose cells, which make up a big chunk of your body, right, they will not be able to respond to insulin, unfortunately, right? And again, still going off of that receptor enzyme problem, right? We talked about maturity onset diabetes of the young last time, right? We said that it's a disorder where you may have like a glucokinase receptor defect, right? And again, we talked about how if you have a glucokinase receptor defect, then your glucose sensing is going to be all screwed up, right? So you may not release insulin you may not release insulin at all, or you may not release insulin in adequate amounts to hyperglycemia. Because again, in a normal person at a blood glucose of like 120 milligrams per deciliter, you may release adequate amounts of insulin, right? But again, in an abnormal person, if you have a glucokinase problem, then that glucose will not be, because remember, glucokinase, we find it in the pancreatic beta islets, right? So if we don't sense things appropriately, we will not convert that glucose to glucose 6-phosphate, and then that glucose 6-phosphate cannot help us make ATP in the pancreatic beta cell, right? So that we can close those potassium channels and secrete insulin, right? In fact, maturity onset diabetes of the young, for the most part, is inherited in an autosomal dominant fashion, right? It's inherited in an autosomal dominant fashion, right? And again, today's topic, again, we're gonna make some integrations here and there, right? So what if they give you a question about a 32-year-old woman, you know, they tell you that she's been having irregular menses, her BMI is 33, right? So she's obese. And then they tell you something about how, you know, again, her periods come very irregularly, and she's been trying to have kids with her husband. She's not making any headway, right? And then they tell you that, you know, she has like these velvety lesions on her skin, and, you know, she has like signs of hyperandrogenism. I would really hope in those circumstances you're thinking about PCOS, right? PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome. Remember, it has a very strong association with people having diabetes. In fact, many of those people, when they have diabetes, you give them metformin. And for some of those people, just giving them metformin alone may be the thing that may make them become pregnant, right? I mean, obviously, if a person has PCOS and you want to try to get them pregnant, you can give them things like... you can give them letrozole, right? Or you can give them clomiphene, right? You can give any of those things. But metformin actually has been reported to help some of these women take it, right? So the thing is, insulin actually plays a big role in the pathophysiology of PCOS. Again, I just don't have time to discuss that today, so I'm just going to keep going, right? And then one other thing your friends at the NBME love to test is they love to test how people that have diabetes, right? If they have hypertension, what kind of thing are you supposed to do to them in terms of treatment? Well, I hope you're saying that, oh, divine, we're going to give them an ACE inhibitor, right? Because again, remember, diabetes torches a person's kidneys. In fact, Diabetes, if I'm not mistaken, is one of the most common causes, if not the most common cause of chronic renal failure in the US, right? So you can kind of stave that off or slow down the progression of kidney damage with an ACE inhibitor, right? And again, we know how that should work, because remember, in diabetes, the thing that happens, and I'll talk about this in more detail in a bit, right? They have this non-enzymatic glycosylation, preferentially of the efferent arterioles. If that happens, right, that, think of non-enzymatic glycosylation of the efferent arterioles as being tantamount to constriction of the efferent arterioles. If you constrict the efferent arterioles, then the hydrostatic pressures in your glomerular capillaries is going to go up. And if that goes up, your GFR is going to be high. So you may be like, Divine, this is great. My GFR is always high. What's the thing? What's the problem with that? Well, let me tell you this. There's definitely going to be a problem with that. Because if that happens, again, your GFR should, your body tries to modulate your GFR in response to changes in afferent arterial perfusion, right? But your GFR is not always high. If your GFR is always high, right, then you're going to be filtering all the time, filtering hard. The thing is, that filtering hard over time will cause something that is known as hyperfiltration injury, right? And that can damage the glomerulus, right? That can damage the glomerulus. And when you damage the glomerulus in that way, then the person is, you know, they're going to go into chronic renal failure, right? And the thing that really happens with ACE inhibitors is angiotensin II is a very powerful constrictor of the efferent arterioles. So if you give an ACE inhibitor, you decrease the production of angiotensin II. And if you do that, then you ultimately cause a dilation of the efferent arteriole, right? And by dilating the efferent arteriole, you're going to increase drainage from the glomerular capillaries. And if you do that, you're essentially lowering the pressure, lowering the hydrostatic pressures in the glomerular capillaries, and that's going to, you know, help. That's going to prevent that hyperfiltration or slow down the rate of that hyperfiltration injury, right? And then, remember, in diabetics, right, again, remember these people, again, they have hyperglycemia, they have high glucose. Remember, glucose is an all-dose sugar. If you remember from organic chemistry in college, glucose is an all-dose sugar. It's not a ketose sugar. Well, it so happens that there is an enzyme known as all-dose reductase that operates in the body, right? In fact, we find it in a bunch of cells, right? We find them in the eyes, or we find them in the retina, or we find them in the kidneys, right? We find them in Schwann cells, right? So all those reductase, what it does when glucose, because of hyperglycemia, right? Because again, I said something that when a person has diabetes, especially like type 2 diabetes, and they have insulin resistance, or again, they have an insulin deficiency, those insulin dependent cells, right? Those cells that depend on insulin to take up glucose, like your adipose cells and your skeletal myocytes, they're not able to take up glucose. Well, guess what? There are insulin dependent cells, but surprise, surprise, there are insulin independent cells, right? So the thing is, whenever there is an insulin deficiency or there's insulin resistance, those insulin independent cells will then start taking up glucose on their own, because there's just more available for them, right? So many of these insulin independent cells, right, like the eyes, like your retina, like your Schwann cells, like your nephrons, they take in that glucose. That glucose is converted by all those reductase to sorbitol, right? Now, the thing is, that sorbitol, some tissues in the body actually have the ability to deal with it, right? Some tissues have this enzyme called sorbitol dehydrogenase that can convert that sorbitol to fructose, right? And then that fructose could potentially diffuse out of the cell. But the thing is, many of these tissues, right, actually don't have sorbitol dehydrogenase. So once glucose is converted by all those reductase to sorbitol, that sorbitol hangs out in those things. And sorbitol is extremely osmotically active. It's going to pull water into those things, like the lens of the eye, right? That can cause cataracts. That's why diabetes is one of the biggest risk factors for cataracts, right? So it brings in that water and, you know, it kind of messes up the lens, right? So it can mess up the lens of the eye, right? So the person can have like blurry vision, right? Again, it can mess up your Schwann cells, right? And again, remember, your Schwann cells are the cells that help you with myelination in your peripheral nervous system. Well, that doesn't work very well anymore when a person has hyperglycemia, right? Again, you can notice these are not adipose cells. These are not muscle cells. These are insulin independent cells. They get a bigger than normal supply of glucose because those insulin dependent cells, like your adipose cells and your skeletal myocytes, are no longer working anymore, right? So again, this should also, let me bring in an integration here with galactose problems, right? So whenever you see a child having a galactose metabolic issue, many of these kids also tend to have cataracts, right? Again, the reason they have cataracts is because galactose is also an aldose sugar, right? So just like aldose reductase can act on glucose and convert it to sorbitol, aldose reductase can act on galactose and convert it to galactitol, right? Galactitol is osmotically active, right? So that's why those kids get cataracts, right? So remember, people can get either galactokinase deficiency, which is less severe, right? Or they can get classic galactosemia, right? Galactose 1-phosphate uridyl transferase deficiency, and they can get in trouble. But usually they get cataracts, right? Usually they get cataracts. And again, some of you may be like, oh, Divine, why does galactokinase deficiency, why is it less severe than essential galactosemia? Well, the thing is, galactokinase deficiency means you cannot convert galactose, right, to galactose 1-phosphate. So you'd be like, oh, Divine, that's so bad. Well, the thing is, it's not so bad because galactose is a 6-carbon sugar, and hexokinase, right, has the ability, almost like non-specifically, to convert 6-carbon sugars to their phosphorylated forms, right? So hexokinase can pick up some of the slack that's taken up by galactokinase. Same thing with fructose, right? Again, essential fructosuria, not a big deal, right? Because again, well, it's a big deal, but it's not that bad because again, that hexokinase can help you deal with that fructose problem. But again, if you notice, people that have fructose metabolic disorders, they don't have those cataract problems. Well, why does that make sense? Again, if you remember from organic chemistry in college, fructose is a ketose sugar, right? Glucose and galactose are all those sugars. All those sugars have the ability to be acted on by all those reductase. But fructose is a ketose sugar. And as far as I know, there's no such thing as ketose reductase in the body. So those things cannot, fructose really is going to have a hard time accumulating in the lens of the eye or whatever, right? So those people usually end up not having too many problems, right? So again, back to this whole issue of non-enzymatic glycosylation, right? So again, this non-enzymatic glycosylation, again, it literally doesn't need any enzymes, right? But whenever you have high amounts of glucose around, glucose can bind with amino acids, right? You can have this condensation reaction. Because remember, amino acids are sort of kind of basic. Glucose is sort of kind of more acidic than them, right? So you can have a condensation reaction, right? And you have this non-enzymatic glycosylation happening, right? And again, when that happens, it will begin to damage the eyes, right? It will damage the retina. It will damage neurons, right? Again, because it's killing Schwann cells. And then it's going to damage the kidneys as well, right? In fact, many times when you have this non-enzymatic glycosylation happening, it creates something that's called an advanced glycosylation product, right? Or some people call it advanced glycosylation end products, right? The thing with those things is they are very destructive, right? So like those things, when they begin to insert in the membranes of things, right? Or they begin to show up in the basement membranes of things, they make those things leaky, right? They make those things leaky, right? So that's one of the reasons why people that have diabetic nephropathy, they have a lot of microalbuminuria, right? And again, these things can make blood vessel walls more leaky, right? So again, all these bad stuff from your bloodstream can begin to leak into your blood vessel walls and cause this thing called hyaline arteriolosclerosis, right? So again, and remember, people can also get diabetic nephropathy, and classically on NBMEs, right? Don't forget that that's associated with those chemostiel, right? K-I-M-M-E-S-T-I-E-L-T-I-E-L, yes? Chemostiel Wilson nodules, right? On histology, right? So that's something you want to keep at the back of your mind on NBME exams. In fact, one nice integration that your friends at the NBME make is, and I'll talk about this some more, with how we screen people for diabetes, right? They may try to see that, they may give you a patient with like hereditary spherocytosis or hereditary elliptocytosis and say, you know, this person, if you want to screen them for diabetes or whatever, what can we do? Well, I would really hope that you're seeing to not, I really hope you don't pick the answer that says to check their hemoglobin A1C, because you may get falsely decreased results, right? Whenever you have some disorder where red blood cells are dying at a rapid clip, right? The A1C is very likely not going to be accurate in those people, right? Because again, remember, your hemoglobin A1C is actually one of these examples of an advanced glycosylation end product, right? So the thing is, it gives you like a very good proxy for what your glucose control has been like within the last 3 months, right? So if for some reason a person has something that's killing their red blood cells very quickly, let's say like sickle cell disease or like hereditary spherocytosis or hereditary elliptocytosis, or let's say a person has some kind of autoimmune hemolytic anemia, in those circumstances, measuring those people's hemoglobin A1C is actually not prudent, right? It's not prudent, right? So again, that's a very nice way they can integrate hemoglobin A1C on an NBM exam, right? And again, please don't forget, right? People that have diabetes, what's the most common cause of death in these people? Well, I would really, really hope you're telling me that, oh, Divine, these people, the most common cause of death in them is going to be an MI, right? It's going to be a myocardial infarction. And usually when people have diabetes, they actually tend to have their like not classic MI symptoms, right? So they can, especially in women, right? So they may not have the chest pain, or they may have like nausea instead of chest pain, right? So again, whenever you see a diabetic and they have abnormal symptoms, I'm saying this for people that are going to become residents in the future. One of the smart things you can do is to just go ahead and check their troponins. You would uncover quite a number of surprises across your career if you did that, right? And again, diabetes, again, like I said, it can cause retinopathy, right? Because again, of that sorbitol business. And there are actually two kinds of retinopathy you need to keep at the back of your mind for NBM exams, right? So you want to keep in mind that there's such a thing as non-proliferative retinopathy and proliferative retinopathy. And the thing is, you actually do need to be able to differentiate between these two on a fundoscopic exam on NBMs, right? So if a person has non-proliferative retinopathy, right, remember, they'll form all these microaneurysms, right? So the NBME, they'll give you these buzzwords in the question, or they may give you these buzzwords as answers. You do need to be able to recognize them, right? So in the case of non-proliferative retinopathy, remember, again, they'll have these microaneurysms, right? They'll have these flame hemorrhages. They'll have these exudates. Those are buzzwords you need to remember. But for the proliferative retinopathy, right, the key term you want to remember on your exam is neovascularization, right? Neovascularization, because you're trying to form all these new blood vessels for whatever bizarre reason, right? In fact, these new blood vessels, as you begin to form them, they can begin to tug on the person's retina, and that can cause retinal detachment. Retinal detachment is a relatively common complication of diabetes on NBME exams, right? And usually when these people have these microaneurysms, they may say, oh, how do you treat them on an NBME exam? Well, you can do things like photocoagulation. Photocoagulation is probably the big buzzword you want to keep at the back of your mind on NBME exams, right? And then don't forget as well, I almost forgot to say this, but in terms of like the bad complications, right? Like usually the first thing that gets torched in a person that has diabetes is actually the eye, right? So those people, they get retinopathy first, and then that retinopathy it basically is way more common, right, than those people getting neuropathy, which is way more common than those people getting nephropathy, right? So just remember, eyes first, followed by neurons, followed by kidneys, right? So eyes first, followed by neurons, followed by kidneys, right? And then again, many of these people that have diabetes, unfortunately, they can develop like peripheral neuropathy, right? So those can cause them to begin to have all these neuropathic ulcers, right? They can have like problems with their reflexes. They can have all these things. And usually when a person has diabetes, if they're trying to get you to treat their neuropathic pain on an NBME exam, I'd hope you're saying, oh, you know what, let's use an SNRI, right? Remember, you can use an SNRI like duloxetine, for example, in these people, right? You can use a tricyclic antidepressant, right? Nortriptyline, amitriptyline, you can use gabapentin, you can use pregabalin for these folks, right? And again, remember, diabetes, because you may be like, Divine, this neuropathy is not a big deal, it's just the lower extremities. No, it's not just the lower extremities. It can also affect your GI tract, right? Remember, there are many neurons that constitute your enteric nervous system. If those neurons don't work very well, you're going to have diabetic gastroparesis, right? And typically, diabetic gastroparesis, how do we treat it? Well, I would hope you're saying, oh, Divine, you know what? We can use a dopamine antagonist like metoclopramide. Well, unfortunately, that metoclopramide can cause drug-induced Parkinsonism, right? In fact, if they give you a neuroleptic malignant-style presentation in a person that has diabetes, right, you want to think about metoclopramide as the treatment for diabetic gastroparesis that's causing those problems, right? Because again, it's essentially an antipsychotic. It's a dopamine receptor antagonist, right? And then remember, you can also use treat diabetic gastroparesis with erythromycin, right? Remember, that's a motiline receptor agonist, so that you can have more flux through your GI tract. And then remember, diabetics, right? Again, on NBME exams, they can also have like neurogenic bladder, right? So remember, neurogenic bladder is the thing that's known as overflow incontinence. So those people's detrusor muscles don't sense adequately when the bladder is full, right? So those people, if you check their post-void residual, it'll be very, very high. It'll be in the hundreds of milliliters on an NBME exam, right? In fact, they can give you a question about a diabetic, right, that has like an ear discharge, has a very painful pinna, right? If you see stuff like that, I want you to think about not just... Because I know when people say, oh, ear discharge, the pinna is hurting, or let me think about otitis externa. Well, the thing is, if you see a diabetic on an NBME exam that has otitis externa, I want you to think about malignant otitis externa, right? Again, many of these things I'm saying, now you may be like, Divine, these things cannot be important until you then see them on an NBME exam, and then you're like, Oh, wait, this stuff is actually high yield, right? Malignant otitis externa is floridly high yield to know for NBM exams, right? And remember, we usually treat this with a fluoroquinolone, right? We can treat it with a fluoroquinolone. We can treat it with acetic acid, right? Usually these people, they tend to get systemic therapy. This is because usually regular otitis externa, you can just put like acetic acid eardrops or whatever and they'll be fine. But for people that have malignant otitis externa, you usually want to give them like IV antibiotics of some sort, right? And then remember that people that also have diabetes, one thing that can happen to them, right? So they can give you a question about a diabetic, and this diabetic has like peripheral arterial disease, right? They tell you that, oh, you know, he walks one block and his legs start hurting until he rests for a while and then he'll get better, right? Well, obviously, if a person has PED, the first thing you're going to do is check their ankle brachial index, right? So if the ankle brachial index is less than 0.9, well, you're kind of out of luck there. Person has peripheral arterial disease. But guess what? What if you measure a person's ankle brachial index and it's like 1.5? It's like much greater than normal, right? If you see that, that doesn't mean that they don't have PED. Remember, when people have diabetes, they can calcify their blood vessels, right? In fact, this is what is known as Munkeberg calcific sclerosis, right? So if they calcify their blood vessels, that's going to cause you to get falsely elevated ankle blood pressure readings, right? So usually for those people, what's going to be your next best step in management? You're going to measure the toe brachial index, and that will give you a more accurate measure of these people having peripheral arterial disease, right? So again, diabetes is not the best thing in the world. And again, just because I need to run to an engagement, I'm going to go ahead and pause here. But again, I will say this, the next podcast I'll make, I'll probably hopefully make it something very, very soon, or probably within the next few hours or days at the most, is going to be diabetes and the USMLE's part 3. Once I'm done with that, we'll be done with diabetes, and you'll have a very complete, thorough understanding of diabetes. Basically, in that podcast, I'm going to be talking about some, again, integrations with some other genetic syndromes and diabetes, with the management of diabetes complications. I'll talk about how diabetes is diagnosed in the first place. I'll talk about it in pregnant women, right? So again, stay tuned for that episode. I think it's something you'll find to be really helpful. And then, as I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams, step one, step two CK, step three, preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams. If you're a medicine resident, actually tutor for the medicine boards and internal medicine in training exam. So if you need tutoring for any of those things, feel free to reach out to me. And again, as you've seen, I have step two CK and step three courses. For step one, I do offer actually a personalized step one course. It's one-on-one, although again, in the future, I would offer, very likely offer group step one courses. But for now, I'm just doing the personalized one-on-one step one course. So if you're interested in any of those things, the personalized step one course, it's kind of tailored to your needs. It can be 20 hours, it can be 30, it can be 40 hours, just kind of depending on what your knowledge base looks like. So if that's something you're interested in, feel free to reach out to me and I'll be happy to give you some more information on that. And then please subscribe to the website Divine Intervention Podcasts with an S.com. Whenever I make a new podcast episode, I always upload it there. And if I make a new podcast episode, if you're subscribed to the website, you will get an email notification. And I do also have a YouTube channel. It's called Divine Intervention USMLE Podcasts and Videos. I'll say that again, Divine Intervention USMLE Podcasts and Videos. The thing is, sometimes some people make these like knockoff YouTube channels. So that's something you want to be careful of. If you want my real content, think about Divine Intervention USMLE Podcasts and Videos. So please subscribe. Whenever I make a video, you'll see it there. And I also have these podcasts on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, on Spotify. So again, you can see the most recent 150 podcasts on those. Again, some people may be like, but Divine, this is episode 302. Where would we find the other episodes? Well, the place you'll find the other episodes will be on the website. Every episode from episode 1 all the way to 302 is there. You can download it from there. You can listen to it there. Again, I unfortunately can't put more than 150. I think it's either a WordPress rule or a podcasting, whatever rule. So it's literally out of my hands. I've literally tried everything else and it doesn't work, right? So again, if you're looking for the everything from episode 1, feel free to get in there. And then one other thing I would say is, If you want to know, because many people ask this question on Reddit, like, Divine, how do I know what podcast to listen to for step one, or what podcast to listen to for step two, CK, step three, what podcast to listen to for so-and-so shelf, whatever. What I would encourage you to do is go to the website, divineinterventionpodcast.com, click on the header that says exam topics list. That will lead you to a spreadsheet that has all the, what is it called? All the different subjects and how they are broken down, right? So I think that's something that'd be helpful, right? Like, I break it down for step one, all the disciplines tested on step one, and all the relevant podcasts for each of those. Step two, CK, step three, all the different disciplines, all the different shelf exams, I break it down one by one, right? And I put the episode numbers. And then you can just go back to the website, and in the search box in the upper right corner, just type in the episode and the topic, boom, and it takes you right to that instead of scrolling and stuff like that. So thank you for listening. I hope you got in something from this podcast. And again, there'll be the final part. I think one more podcast should tackle all of our diabetes needs, and then we'll go from there. So thank you for listening to me. God bless you. Have a wonderful and safe day, and remain blessed. Shalom.